This is the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley. It's easy for us today to snicker at the primitive medicine of the past. We've stopped thinking the bumps on your head are signs of how intelligent you are. We have better knowledge and tools than in the past. But plenty of reports indicate medicine can still have blind spots, especially for women. Elizabeth Coleman points out a number of them in the book All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. Elizabeth Coleman is herself an MD, a medical oncologist who specializes in breast cancer treatment. Dr. Coleman is also an assistant professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City. Elizabeth Coleman, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, so the title, All in Her Head, I would wish for you that you'd never heard that phrase in person, but I bet you have.
Yes, unfortunately, you know, when coming up with the title for this book, it was a little bit of a winding road till we said this, All in Her Head, and everybody kind of jumped and said, well, that's the title of the course of the book, of course. And then when I've been speaking and talking about it, far too many women say, of course this title resonates with me. I've heard it, you know, you need to calm down. It's all in your head. You're just anxious. It really touches a chord.
The things that doctors say obviously make up much of the book, but you also give us some of the things that patients say. And one of them is, I'm so sorry for sweating on you. Why do you hear that phrase so much?
I think the phrase that I hear on repeat and in so many different contexts is, I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. We as women, in many instances, historically, culturally, from all angles, have been told to not take up as much space, not make people uncomfortable. And within that, there is, I think, a legacy of apologizing, and apologizing oftentimes for normal bodily functions, whether it's not shaving our armpits or our legs or not getting a pedicure before we go to the doctor, or including sweating, and sweating even in the most intense of circumstances, which I talk about in my book.
So women are much more likely to apologize to a doctor for just about anything, it sounds like.
I think women are more likely to apologize more just in general, but yes, also in the doctor's office.
I don't think you use the term, but this is really institutional sexism, isn't it? Our modern medical system is not completely disconnected from the old all males all the time system before it.
Yes. I mean, one of the viewpoints that I have in this book is, of course, I talk about history, but it is not about a war of the sexes or to say that men cannot be fantastic healers, because they can be, and we know that across the spectrum. And also, it's not to say that our history was built only by poorly intentioned, misogynist men. Some were very well intentioned, who just were influenced by culture or were making the best decisions they could at the time. But the reality is, our system was not built for women or by listening to women. So the goal of this work is really to change that narrative and to not be so black and white about it or simplistic, but to really say that human nature is complex, women's role in society is complex, and that it necessarily influences our healthcare system and all of our societal systems as well.
There are so many great stories in the book, and not all of them are specifically about medicine. Would you tell the one about the important Viking grave found in the late 19th century?
Sure. So I was always fascinated by archaeology, and this is just a story that really highlights perception and how important that is when conducting science. Whether it's science, medicine, archaeology, none of it exists in a vacuum, but it's inextricably linked to the people that are searching it, discovering it, asking the questions about it. So in my intro, I talk about a Viking warrior that was uncovered at various points in history. This Viking warrior was analyzed, and it was buried with all sorts of paraphernalia associated with being a warrior. And even though the skeleton was really clearly from a woman, the assumptions were over time that how could this possibly be a woman? And the questions were raised, but it was not until DNA analysis years later in the 20th century that a woman was really able to prove that this was a woman's body as well, and that she, too, could have been a warrior.
And the stuff that was buried with the warrior indicated the importance of this person. Was that part of the reason that they couldn't accept that it could be a woman?
Well, I can't go back into the minds of the people that dug this amazing warrior up, but you do wonder about what we perceive women to be capable of. And throughout history, it is not that women could be strong. And I do believe that influenced the perception of who and what this warrior was about and worthy of when she was discovered.
Dr. Elizabeth Coleman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. The chapters in the book go through the 11 organ systems in the body, from the skin to the sex organs. Does this approach more or less mimic medical training?
Yes, one of the reasons why I organized it this way was to really show that women's medicine and women's health is not just the derivative of bikini medicine, which I call just thinking about our reproductive function, our reproductive organs, and occasionally our breasts. We are head-to-toe different than men. We are not small men. And to understand women's health is to understand how the biology translates to every organ system in the body, head-to-toe. And so the book is organized as a walk through women's body by organ system, the same way medical students learn about the body and physiology, and which in turn mirrors the specialties that evolved out in the 19th century when medical science really evolved to have these subspecialties that did not exist before.
And the skin chapter, the first of them, moves quickly from rebuilding people after World War I to plastic surgery for women. How did we get there and get there so fast?
Well, it's a very interesting history because the rise of plastic surgery was built on the battlefields and the ability to reconstruct soldiers' faces. With the rise of weaponry and new techniques to really destroy other humans with war and weapons was also the rise of anesthesia and the ability to operate on people who had disfigured faces and to do it slowly when they needed anesthesia and without pain as opposed to amputations and gangrenous limbs, which, you know, you had to do without any anesthesia, holding down somebody. Maybe they were in a drunken stupor, and you had to, and the surgeons were lauded by how quickly they could do it within minutes because you had no time. Now you could operate on people carefully, thoughtfully, and without pain. What that also meant is this rise of a field where we always knew beauty was part of women's value in society, but now you could think about changing women's faces, women's bodies, even if they were healthy. Many of the chapters in the book are how women's health was ignored, but the history of plastic surgery is really the opposite of how women became really pathologized and in turn capitalized on in some aspects of plastic surgery. Now, this isn't to say that I don't believe in vanity or I don't believe the real value in dermatology and plastic surgery. I do. It's just important to know the roots of it, especially when you're going to the doctor's office today.
It's interesting, though, when you think about some of the things in here. Well, you talk about breast implants in that chapter, and these are things that that men might like as much as women. So what do you know? We developed medicine fast there.
Mm-hmm. And it certainly was not developed with breast cancer patients or mastectomies as part of the original motivation. Of course, we've since evolved to incredible reconstructive techniques, but that was not the initial intention when breast implants were developed. This was really for aesthetic reasons, to take a healthy woman and improve or change her appearance. And that, again, was not built upon the need of really the mastectomy patients who were really suffering from body image issues, many of them.
Well, talk about that, because that's your line of work. I mean, how often do your mastectomy patients seek cosmetic surgery to, quote unquote, feel like themselves again?
Often, and I really encourage it. The beauty of what's offered today is that should we really take the time to listen to women, what women want in the setting of breast cancer, it is a whole spectrum of choices and options that ideally reflect what the woman wants for herself. There's some women that want absolutely no reconstruction and want their breasts removed with just an incision and a scar, and that's it. Other women want something that's called an aesthetic flap closure, which is where they get to keep more of their skin and their nipple and lose the breast tissue underneath, usually in a preventative setting where they don't necessarily have breast cancer, but need to have their breasts removed due to an increased biological risk. Other women may want implants, and still others may want no foreign substance in their body and choose something called a deep flap procedure, which is where if their body can is the right habitus for it, you can use the abdominal fat, abdominal body tissue, and pull that up to make a very realistic-looking breast for some women.
Wow. So we move from skin onto bones and our long knowledge of the skeleton. I mean, you know, we know about bones from being kids and everything, but the male skeleton is what we focused on, though. They're really not the same.
They're not the same. And whether you look at the angle of the hips to the knees and how that relates to ligament ACL injuries in female athletes, or the hip ratio or our thoracic cavity, our bones are different. And also our knees are different over time. We know that, for example, falls are a real risk of both men and women, but osteoporosis is something that really needs to be addressed, particularly for women as they are at unique risk as well.
Elizabeth Coleman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. So you spent some time on scoliosis, curvature of the spine, and there have been a bunch of wrong turns treating this serious situation.
Yes. So scoliosis is, as you said, curvature of the spine, and predominantly affects women. And one of the things that I really was interested in is, what did people say about women over time about the cause of this? Really everything from masturbation to why they shouldn't sit in classrooms because they were hunched over at desks and education was bad for them, to the idea that women and minority women were more primal and therefore more likely to be hunched over and ape-like, and this is why their spines were curved. There were all sorts of clearly culturally laden beliefs that infiltrated our understanding of scoliosis, as well as whether the idea that women needed to be active. And, you know, there were some doctors that supported braces for scoliosis, others that suggested gymnastics for women and exercises therein. But throughout the history of understanding scoliosis was really a lot of doctors at times trying to do good, but many of them really harming women in the process.
So do we understand better now, for example, the bone issues that affect mostly women later in life, you know, the postmenopausal women, osteoporosis, that whole realm? Are we doing better in that realm?
Of course. I think we're doing better on all realms. You're having me on your show, so we're talking about it. We're changing the narrative. We're working as a society and a medical system to improve the lives of women. So, of course, there is more that we understand about women's health, including their bone health. But I see lots of women who are not aware that strength training is really important for their bone health. They are most focused on losing weight and being thin, as opposed to thinking about how they can make sure that their bone integrity stays strong over time.
You know, I had a feeling the old stories could get worse as we move into the chapter on muscles, and the answer is yes, they can. Talk about the way that people in the 19th century, or at least some people in the 19th century, medical authorities, had views of women spending too much time on bicycles.
This was really a shock to me, and one that I laugh about in retrospect, but really must have been horrible. Think about the first time you rode a bike as a kid. It's thrilling, it's exhilarating, you have freedom from your home, maybe freedom from your parents, you get to ride your bike to the park. Well, in the turn of the 19th century, riding a bike was really an exciting pastime, but it also gave women freedom from their home. They didn't need a horse and buggy. They didn't need anybody with them to chaperone them on their biking adventures. It also became the symbol of the suffrages movement. And in that, you also see doctors coming out in medical journals concerned, and in the lay press, concerned that women might obtain bicycle face, that their faces might be frozen in a grimace if they work out too hard or bike up the hill, about what they could wear, about how far they could go. And you really see doctors becoming the moral arbiters of what women could do in terms of physical fitness. And of course, they also raise concerns that women would be masturbating too much on the bike.
Okay, that's twice you've touched on masturbation. Let's go there, because this comes up a lot. I mean, and bones, muscles, I mean, things that go wrong with women. This is believed, I think, into the 20th century, that this idea that you could damage the body structures, and seriously, by masturbating.
Yeah, so I never expected to discover all of this in my research. And by the end, I was like, okay, now I'm not surprised. But with every organ system, there was some founding father, someone who was fixated on either clamping down women's sexual desire, talking about masturbation, and or claiming that, you know, women's sexual function really was to be framed in the context of her husband and only that. And or the idea that women's sexuality in turn made them vulgar, it made them dirty, they were more likely to carry STDs. We need to worry about women that were infecting soldiers, you know, during various wars, as opposed to the soldiers that could be infecting women. At every step of this lingering specter of the sexual woman, you see it seeping into what doctors said women could and could not do, could and could not feel, and what medical ailments they felt were a result of this nature, including whether, you know, the hysterical woman just needed more sex or less sex. It was absolutely shocking to me, and not what I expected to find.
We're just a couple seconds to a break, but it seems like that a lot of experts thought women were basically different species.
Yes. So either we're different species, or we were the inverted, imperfect woman or imperfect version of the male. So very interesting, the different theories over time. But there has never been a Western medical thought that elevated women's bodies, minds, capacities as equivalent or in any way superior to a man.
We'll pick this up on the other side of a break. Elizabeth Komen is our guest, a medical doctor practicing in New York City and a medical teacher as well at medical school. The book is All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in just a bit. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. We're learning about medicine, but we're actually learning about medicine, we hope it's past, because it's the way that medicine used to look upon women and has only grudgingly given up over time. The book is written by a medical professional herself. Elizabeth Komen is an MD in practice in New York City, a medical oncologist and an assistant professor of medicine. She wrote the book All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. We pointed out that you take us through the 11 organ systems in the body through the chapters in the book. So when we turn to blood, I'm thinking, oh, well, everything's the same there between men and women. Oh, boy. And then you start talking about chlorosis. What was that?
So chlorosis was a very interesting social construct of a disease. So it was probably an amalgam of a lot of different things that, looking back, in part included iron deficiency anemia in retrospect. But when you look throughout history, there was this green sickness that, even going back to Hippocrates, was talked about in the literature, but especially came to be a common diagnosis among 19th century Victorian women. And the idea here was it was almost glorified as a rite of passage, particularly if you were upper class, because, you know, you were wearing a corset perhaps, you were dainty, you were not eating a lot of red meat, and you were fainting and feeling weak. And in retrospect, probably many of these girls had iron deficiency anemia, but it was a harbinger of some of the other things that we glorified about women being sick and romanticized, whether it was chlorosis, whether it was tuberculosis and the consumptive woman who is ever so frail, maybe bleeding from her mouth and breathless and thin, or the heroin chic, or maybe the woman that's on Ozempic now trying to fit into her size 2 jeans.
Let's skip ahead, actually, and talk about the breath part of the book, because I couldn't believe that part of it. You're just in the realm of what you're talking about. Tuberculosis was once something of a sign of femininity?
Sure, yeah. So really glorified in medical literature, in art, in literature, and in poetry, the idea that the woman dying from tuberculosis was a picture of beauty. And you can see that throughout history and throughout literature, and really tragically kind of sums up what we have valued and not valued in our medical history.
Like a statue and as pale as one, in essence.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. How often, Elizabeth, do you stop and think about what people in 150 or 200 years will think of the medical practices of our time?
All the time. All the time. I think that's part of, you know, I won't be alive then. But I feel compelled to be part of a mission to make women's health, which I think relates to all of our health, better. I hope, you know, the idea that the patient is at the center of our healthcare system is not a new concept. If you go back and look at Francis Peabody's speech to Harvard Medical School, I believe in the 1930s, although I may be getting that date wrong, he talks about the secret of caring for the patient is caring for the patient. The idea that we want to be seen as whole and as human and valued, not just as broken up pieces of specialties, but as a full, soulful, heart-filling person is not a new concept. We all want to be validated for our pain and seen and cared for, particularly when we're ill. We all have concerns throughout history that technology would break us up into bits and pieces and not see us for what we are. And I think we see that playing out in our healthcare system today and shortened appointments, fragmented electronic medical records where we spend, for every minute that we spend seeing a patient, we have to spend 3 minutes on the back end documenting that. And the rise of technology has also meant that we talk to people less. We know that the more we talk to patients, the better we'll get at a diagnosis, not necessarily rushing to tests and imaging them, whether it's blood tests or CAT scans. I think the concern, especially with the rise of artificial intelligence, is what does the future of healthcare look like? And all this push to advance technology, will we lose those ineffable qualities and traits of being a healer that I think, whether it was the ancient Greeks or an appointment with a doctor's office today, we are, as a function of our humanity, all seeking.
So where you teach at Weill Cornell Medical College, is much time spent on getting the story from patients, from getting the narrative, from conversational, even interviewing skills, reflective listening, that sort of thing?
So there are a number of medical schools across the country that are increasingly dedicated to this. And in my own practice, sometimes I'll have medical students with me and we talk about how to connect with patients. And I think there are lots of different efforts moving forward. NYU, for example, has a Center for Empathy, which is extraordinary. And I think those of us who went into medicine and truly see it as a calling want to see that ethos continued moving forward. And that includes inspiring younger generations about what it means to care for patients and value the profession.
Let's come back to the history part of this. And you mentioned Harvard Medical School. And I want to bring in Nanette Winger and her contributions to medicine.
Sure. What an honor it was to speak with her. So she was one of the early female graduates of Harvard Medical School. And my God, was she a trailblazer. She really was one of the first women. She's in her 90s, still practicing in Atlanta, Georgia. And she was one of the first women to really recognize that women's heart disease is being missed, that we need to do a better job of particularly caring for women with heart disease. It continues to be the number one killer of women in the United States. And we are woefully behind in terms of diagnosing, catching, and treating and preventative care for women with heart disease. When I was in medical school, and certainly I don't even know if they referred to it when she was in medical school, but we were taught that women's chest pain and the way they present with a heart attack was atypical. Well, we're greater than 50% of the population, and heart disease is the number one killer of women. Why do we consider it atypical chest pain? That really reflects, again, this ancient idea that we are inverted, imperfect, atypical versions of the ideal reference male. You see this play out in clinical trials of early aspirin drugs or cholesterol drugs for heart disease, which included tens of thousands of men and not a single woman. So Nanette Winger has changed the field and continues to be a leader trying to advance from prevention to diagnosing to treating heart disease in women. And she's just simply extraordinary.
So you're saying that the knowledge of heart disease has come along even in the time since you were in medical school?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm grateful for that.
Let's move on to the respiratory system, because you say attending to respiratory system is coded as self-care for women, not healthcare. What do you mean?
Well, you have all these apps and things about meditating and breathing, yet there are lots of things that we miss in women who may have pulmonary problems. A lot of times women are dismissed as being anxious when they could have asthma. We know that pregnant women can have unique pulmonary conditions and or be dismissed because the assumption is, well, they're growing belly, their growing uterus is pressed up on their diaphragm, and that's why they're short of breath. Well, in speaking to many pulmonologists, including a colleague of mine from Harvard Med School, Sonali Bose, she talks about how lots of things can be missed in pregnant women because we may be more afraid to take care of pregnant women and or we haven't studied them properly, including the effects of pollution as well as physiology on their pulmonary diseases and presentation. Serena Williams, for example, talks about how she developed a pulmonary embolism, a blood clot, when she had her baby and she was delivering. And this was initially dismissed as something like anxiety. So when we have somebody as strong and as powerful going through our medical system, such as Serena Williams, really being dismissed, what happens to the average woman who does not have the same resources and agency and perhaps capacity to advocate? It's quite frightening.
Elizabeth Cohen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. Continuing along with the respiratory system, man, there's a story you give in here that just curls the hair. A woman who was short of breath and coughed, and how many doctors did she see till somebody finally got it right?
Well, I mean, the reality is many of these stories in this book are a composite of women that I've met along the way or stories that I've heard about. And many, many women in the hospital far too many times are dismissed when they may have actual real pulmonary symptoms, whether it's from a clot, fluid in their lungs, or some other etiology, as being anxious. Because when you can't breathe, you get anxious. So it's a vicious cycle. And many of the pulmonologists or intensive care unit doctors that I spoke to spoke about the importance of really recognizing and making sure we don't dismiss women when they have those symptoms.
Let's talk about hormones, because this is a big part of women's health and a big part that still seems to be not well understood. My life partner has issues that we had to get addressed by endocrinologists, and it just seems like it goes on and on and on before somebody finally says, oh, well, this is what you probably need to do. And even then, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of mm-hmm. mistakes get made there.
Yes, I mean, and we're really playing catch up with understanding how to guide women and their hormone health throughout their lifetime. The discovery of hormones historically was really the idea, oh, there's going to be these hormones that make women women and men men. And this reductionist view has misled our understanding of estrogen and testosterone, both in men and women. When it comes to hormone replacement therapy, we've swung women in all sorts of different directions, from early on telling them all women should be on hormone replacement therapy to saying, oh my God, no, this is what's going to cause breast cancer and really overinflating the risk, to now really leaving women with the need to have really thoughtful, personalized discussions about what hormone replacement therapy may be right for them.
Well, and it just seems like there's so many people who just want to hit a number. It's like, you know, your thyroid needs to be in this range. Hit these numbers and you're fine.
Yes, well, we are not numbers, though. We know that. And really taking care of anybody requires not reducing them to a mere number.
You mentioned hysteria earlier. This is something that used to get said a lot. You know, hysteria, hysterectomy. You can figure out the root words here. But so we're not diagnosing hysteria anymore. But is there still some shadow of it that falls across modern medicine?
Absolutely. I think the ghost of the hysterical woman continues to haunt medical practice today. The idea of a hysterical woman goes back to the Greek word for womb, and the idea that this wandering womb is what made women so crazy. Of course, we know that the womb is not wandering, but is tethered internally. But this idea of women's reproductive organs making her crazy continues to pervade our healthcare system. In the 1980s, hysterical as a diagnosis was finally removed from the diagnostic criteria.
In the 80s?
But, yes, in the 1980s. But I think that the idea of the anxious, hysterical woman still plays out in our medical system today.
Let's stay on the lower end of the body. I kind of made my jaw drop when I read that women, particularly well into adulthood, can have enlarged colons. From what?
Well, what I was talking about there in interviewing different gastroenterologists was that, you know, women can suffer disproportionately from constipation. That's a vicious cycle that in turn can elongate or make their colons more tortuous. And we don't necessarily know the reasons why. I spoke to Dr. Susan Lusick about that. She's a gastroenterologist who specializes in some of the irritable bowel disorders that some women may face. But she also talks about how there can be shame in women going to the bathroom, or that, you know, a mom may never be able to have a minute to herself, but the dad gets to kind of relax in the bathroom, and, you know, how that relates to their bowel function.
Wow. All right, there's a story of your own right under our last 2 minutes or so here, but you have your own experience as a patient. You've got a back condition corrected, and it led off into something else.
Yes. Well, the story in my book really highlights that the idea of doctor heal thyself can be a little bit complicated. So much like I was trying to write this book to advocate for women, it was also an understanding of myself. And towards the end of writing this book, I had my own medical condition, really suffered from a lot of pain, and had a very challenging time advocating for myself and going with my gut and my medical experience about what I felt was wrong with me. It really gave me a lot of insight into the reality that far too many women with less resources, less access, continue to suffer and really need improved advocacy in our healthcare system.
So you were meeting other doctors, fellow physicians, who were saying, oh, no, it's not what you think it is. It's what I think it is.
Yes, and I believe them.
Wow. So more women are going than men into medicine now in the United States, aren't they?
They are, but I think it's also about making sure that the traits that are historically viewed as more feminine, that women listen better and longer, is not something that is unique to women, but something that we can value in men as well and in our healthcare system. Additionally, just because we have more women doesn't mean that there are more women in positions of power. We need to make sure that women have a seat at the table, both in patient advocacy groups, but also in leadership positions in academia and medical institutions.
The book is All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today by Dr. Elizabeth Komen, specializing in medical oncology in New York City and also an assistant professor at Weill Cornell Medical College. Thank you so much for sharing this with us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for today's JX. Check out this and all interviews on the web at jeffexchange.org or go to your favorite podcast site for a download. Angela Decker is our senior producer. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening and have a great day.